give you my theory on film collectors of my generation, which is admittedly most collectors. We've handled film for so long that its molecules have become fused with ours. And we've become part film. As a matter of fact, we've become movie monsters. And that's really what film collecting is. One long monster movie.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about a new film that celebrates film. It's a documentary about analog films and the people who've rescued them from the landfill. It's called Film is Dead, Long Live Film. And we have the director with us, Peter Flynn. Welcome
Hello.
To Words and Pictures.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by our old friend, Greg Hamilton. Greg is a film archivist and documentarian in Portland, Oregon, and he's helping bring Film is Dead, Long Live Film to the Pacific Northwest. Always a pleasure, Greg.
Always a pleasure, Conch. Thank you for having us on again.
So, Peter, you are a professor of media production and film history at Emerson College in Boston, and you've directed a number of documentaries, including The Dying of the Light, a celebration of 35-millimeter projectionists.
Yes, I'm a bit of a one-trick pony, really. This is I have a deep, deep interest in film history, and I don't stray too far from that subject matter. So most of my work is related to film and film history and the forgotten aspects of film history, the aspects of our history that don't end up in the textbooks.
Well, give us a little bit of an introduction to Film is Dead, Long Live Film. We're not talking about so-called digital film or digital cinema packages. We're talking about those photochemical films on cellulose acetate that have been around for over a century.
Absolutely. We're talking about analog photochemical film and the people who've devoted their lives to saving and preserving that. You know, the studios and the rights holders of these films have never been particularly good parents. They've never been good stewards. And in their minds, the film had a certain lifespan. It had a certain job to do. It had a profit to make. And once that job was completed and those earnings were pulled in, the film had no more value to the studios. So films were routinely junked, left to rot and decay. And, a very small and very passionate group of people devoted their time to pulling films out of dumpsters and saving and preserving not just the films, but the technology that to run the films, projectors, cameras, and the knowledge of handling that film, saved and preserved that for future generations because they saw value in it that the studios and copyright holders obviously didn't. And thanks to that, so much of our history and so many films survive today that would otherwise have been lost to history. So this film was an attempt to kind of acknowledge the efforts of these people and to capture something of their culture. You know, most of these people tend to be in the older age bracket. They tend to be boomers. They tend to have come of age in the post-war years. At that point when film was everywhere, right? Film was in the home in the form of 8 and 16 millimeter. It was in the school and it was in every neighborhood movie house. And that generation of people, I think, were the last real generation to fully absorb celluloid film. And now, of course, they're getting up there and that culture is going. And with that boomer culture, those boomer cinephiles, I think a great deal will be lost, a great deal of our understanding of what film was and how it was consumed and how it was embraced and loved will be lost with them. So this film is an attempt to kind of not just honor these people, but to capture some of their culture and some of that love, that old school analog cinephilia before it's gone.
I was just going to say how very excited I am to help bring Film is Dead, Long Live Film here to Portland. It really is. It's a love letter to cinema, but it is also a rallying cry for the importance of film preservation. Part of the reason why I'm bringing this film to Portland now is that I've been working on this project, working with the Dennis Nyback Archive of 16 millimeter film. And it in many ways parallels some of the things that are in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where you have large collections of films that all of a sudden no longer have an owner and are no longer spoken for. And I've been very lucky in that the Portland film community, the 16 millimeter appreciators, as it were, have banded together with me to go out and save this collection and put it into an archive that we're going to take and put back out into the community in the form of programs, much like what Dennis did when he was alive. So yeah, no, I'm really excited about this film, and I hope it's like a springboard to share the love of what we're doing, which is to take all of these little bits and pieces of history and culture and entertainment and put them into a package so that people can enjoy them again. But also, it's a memory bank, and that's never been more important these days, honestly, with the way things are going. It's we need to remember the past, and this is an important component to that.
One of the things that I think is very important and very lovely about what you're doing is you're keeping a collection together. All too often when a collector passes away, an archive may take a certain number of films. Another number will be sold to one collector, another portion, and the collection gets broken up and watered down, and it loses its personality. It loses that kind of binding glue that held all these, in some cases, very disparate films together, was a personality. A sensibility around film. And that all too often gets lost. The collector gets lost. The person who amassed this collection, who saved so much, gets erased from the history of these films. So I think it's very important to acknowledge the collector, to acknowledge the person who spent 4 decades, 5 decades of their lives putting this together and creating this unique personality-driven collection. And you keep that collector's mission alive in many ways.
Yeah, there's a very active film preservation community in Portland. Gary Locker is kind of the dean, at least when it comes to 35 millimeter films. And as you mentioned, we recently lost Dennis Nyback, whose collection of thousands of 16 millimeter films was shown all over the world. And talking about Dennis Nyback, that's kind of germane because he would put together collections of old Warner Brothers and Walt Disney cartoons. Bad Bugs Bunny was one of the titles of the shows he put on. And this was at the point where the studios were sanitizing their old cartoons, and they didn't like audiences seeing some of those wacky, violent scenarios and shall we say, insensitive portrayals of ethnicity. So Dennis would get the occasional cease and desist letter from Ted Turner or from the House of Mouse, which he'd just ignore.
Yeah, no, his programs were so, there was so much variety. I remember him telling me one time, he said, "You give me a subject and I'll make a program for you." From everything from popular culture to sports to religion, it was endless. And he took those programs, like you said, all over the world. And we were just particularly blessed here in the Pacific Northwest because he lived up here for a fair amount of his career and put the shows on here in Portland and in the around surrounding area. So that's part of the motivation too, is to like to keep that going and to really to dig into the idea and the enthusiasm that Dennis had for the broad spectrum of film and the different stories that it can tell. And so that's, I mean, if there is a mission for the archive, it's to take these, all of these desperate little pieces and put them together into things that people can enjoy, but also look at over and over if they want to. History, we want it to repeat itself in this case.
Well, let's play a clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film.
The complete history of film just doesn't exist. Basically, everybody threw that history away. And it's collectors like me that jumped into the bins, garbage cans, started collecting stuff. And then when people started saying, "Hey, what happened to this film?" somebody in the woodwork had it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking about Film is Dead, Long Live Film. This is a documentary about preserving the analog photochemical films that played in cinemas for well over a century before digital came along. We're joined today by director Peter Flynn, as well as film archivist Greg Hamilton. Peter, one of the heroes of your film is Rick Prelinger of the Internet Archive. And Rick is one of those folks who's been around a very long time. In fact, before the Internet Archive, there was the Prelinger Archive, and it was all analog material. I can remember that from when I was in film school. Without getting too off topic, archive.org is getting a lot of attention at the moment for preserving public data, while the new regime in Washington tries to scrub government websites of information they don't like.
Yeah. Rick is a great case in point here because, you know, we have the Library of Congress, we have the National Archives, and they save and preserve a certain type of film, the big films. One of the great values of private film collectors is that they tend to be focused on very specific genres or very specific eras or types of films. And Prelinger, of course, is focused primarily on home movies. And who's saving and preserving home movies? Very few people. He spearheaded a contemporary interest in home movies that, you know, I don't know if it would exist without Prelinger's efforts to put them out there and make people aware of them. So that was a whole genre of filmmaking and a whole history of film, over 100 years of amateur filmmaking, that would be completely forgotten if it weren't for the efforts of people like Rick Prelinger to save and preserve films that we just don't think of as film. When we think of film, we think of 35 millimeter studio release pictures. We think of theatrical films. We don't think of all these other parts of film history. And as a result, they tend to get forgotten and lost and fall between the cracks. So collectors with their own idiosyncratic focuses prove a blessing in saving and preserving the lesser known material. And Prelinger is a shining case in point, I think.
Yeah, there is so much in the cinematic universe. And as the people that are working on the Nyback Archive are going through it right now, we're just stunned by the variety and the quality. And just there's just so many different things from, like you said, from like home movies to educational films, to news spots, to documentaries, to all sorts of things that were made and are locked into that format of 16 millimeter. And that's, they have not been digitized. They have not been placed anywhere else.
Yeah. 16 is to me the most interesting of formats because everything is on 16. You have all the major releases that would have been issued to TV stations and schools and so on in 16 millimeter. But then you have educational films, you have all movies, amateur, experimental films, TV commercials, news, you know, 5 decades of TV news on 16 millimeter. So much is on 16 millimeter. It really is, for me, the most fascinating and interesting of gauges. And you can take it home and you can project it on a wall.
I know exactly what you mean. I do it all the time. I've been doing film programming, 16 millimeter film programming here in Portland for about 20 years now. You know, in that time, I put together a few shows of my own. But what I love to capitalize is that variety. Like one of my shows, the Psychotronic After School Special, is a mix of all of those things. So like you'll go in there and there'll be commercials, there'll be PSAs, there'll be educational films, and so on and so forth. And it's meant to celebrate all of it. Because the great thing about that is, you know, Dennis did before me, is that, you know, he'd take themes and then just build into that. So whether it was drug scare films or whether it was what it is to navigate your government, there's so many different topics and it's so well and diversely represented in film, 16 millimeter film specifically, to make sense to do it.
And of course, Greg, you're taking material that was probably meant to be seen in a classroom and you're putting it in a movie house. And it becomes something else, right? It becomes something very different. It has a new life in a way. I think that's we kind of reinvent these old films when we show them in a different way, and we make them relevant again to audiences that were never intended to see these films. They become something new and something different.
Hey Peter, let me ask you a question about your film. In the process of making it, I mean, was there a moment in there that you really felt that the film came together, that it crystallized, that there was something that the story was going to be manifest in this particular place?
There were definitely moments where I thought, oh wow, now I can begin to see the film. But the roadmap was fairly clear to me from the get-go, because the first shooting I did with a film collector called Lou de Crescenzo. And Lou was at that stage in his life where he'd spent 50 years collecting films and film projectors, and he was now too unwell to really take care of it. So he was passing it on. And he realized that he needed to pass on the films, the projectors and the equipment, the love of it, to help generate an excitement for an audience. So like yourself, he was showing these films at movie theaters, putting together his own programs, bringing the projector out into the audience. And also he realized he needed to pass on the knowledge of how to handle and project this film. So he was training somebody to take over. And that, to me, very early on defined what this film was about. It was about the need to pass this on. And in doing so, when passing all this stuff on, you pass something of yourself on, and you become, in a way, immortal. You live on, you defy death. And Lou always said, you'll end your film with a dedication to me. And I would laugh it off, and he was right. I did, because he passed away just as I was putting the final touches to the film. So he gave the film its structure, and he gave the film its themes. And thanks to him, I knew exactly where I needed to go with the film. But then there was little moments. Like, for instance, I remember interviewing a collector, Ray Fayola. We're sitting in a screening room, and he's talking about 16 and his favorite film prints and all of this stuff, which is fascinating to me. And then he says, "Do you mind if let me bring my wife in? You can interview her." And I thought, "Well, okay, if you want, Ray, I really want to hear about your King Kong print, but okay." And in comes Ray's wife, Ariella. And she completely blows me away. And she's so passionate and so articulate. And she introduced this element that I hadn't fully latched onto in the beginning. And that is the impact that a collector has on their immediate circle, their family members and their children. And it's not always a positive one. It can be very difficult to live with. Just that difficulties of managing a social life and a marriage and all the obligations when you have this mountainous collection to tend to as well. And so Ray and Ariella opened up the scope of the film, and I realize now I have to talk to the children and the partners of collectors as well to get a sense of what that impact is. And that gave the film a lot more heart and a lot more honesty too. I mean, there's a dark side to collecting. There can be a dark side to collecting. It wreaks a lot of damage and a lot of havoc on people's lives and their health. The collections can take over. And that, became a part of the film. But I think ultimately what came through was a great sense of love and admiration for people who themselves have a great deal of love and admiration for something. It was a great journey, and it was very bittersweet. It wasn't bittersweet, it was very sad to finish the film and kind of put it away, and because I'm not out of this world. I'm not, done with this.
Well, there are some moments of suspense in the film, in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where the collectors are going into leaky garages where all these films have been kept for years.
There's a lot of adventure and peril in this hobby. I think the natural evolution of a film collector is they encounter it in that primal moment in their childhood. They encounter it in the classroom, or they encounter it at home with an 8mm Laurel and Hardy on the wall, and boom, they're hooked. So they go to their local camera store and they pick up Black Hawk and Castle Films, which were the dominant companies for producing at-home movies. And then they grow out of that and they want the forbidden fruit. And the forbidden fruit is 16mm television prints. So how do you get 16 millimeter television prints? Well, you bribe somebody at the local TV station and they meet you at the back door and you walk off with an episode of Hogan's Heroes or I Love Lucy or whatever it is. And then that forbidden fruit leads to more forbidden fruit. And next thing you know, you're outside the law, right? For many, it moves on to 35 millimeter film collecting. And that's when you really enter into the outlaw territory. You know, now you're bribing a projectionist to, you know, look the other way while you walk out of a theater with a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Or you're going to the film depot and bribing somebody there and you're taking out prints that you have no right to possess and own. And then the local movie house closes down and you have a crowbar and you're opening the back door and you're climbing through and you're with a flashlight climbing your way up to the projection booth and picking out whatever you have there. So it kind of grows and expands.
Yeah, I count myself very lucky that I've not had to do that. A lot of the films that I acquired when I started doing this, I found through affinity groups. I found, over the internet, of course. But what's interesting, as we built this archive and we've got it established, we have been approached by collectors that are essentially looking to pass on what they have put together over their years. And so, not only do we have what Dennis collected, which was 40 years, about 4,500 films, even more, I think we're still finding out. But we've had other collectors that have come to us and say, "Hey, would you like to, have our archive included as well?" And so, Yeah, I didn't have to break any doors down or bribe anybody to bring the films over at this point in time. And what's great is that we're getting collections that have been curated. And so who knows, what we'll find. That's the
I
great
mean,
thing.
there's a whole history to this, right? You know, and initially going back to the early days of film, you have the transition to sound in the late 20s, and now all of a sudden, all these silent films and silent projectors have no value whatsoever, and they're being junked and tossed out. And boom, you have the first generation of collectors who swoop in and take whatever they can from the dumpsters and the old theaters. And then you jump forward to the TV era when the TV stations are junking all their film prints because they've moved over to tape. And then you have another wave of collectors. You have the moment when a lot of theaters, the old single screen theaters, are closing down and you've got a lot of people, you know. And then there were the drive-in closures in the 80s and 90s. And you have again a lot of people going into the drive-ins and taking stuff out. And now we've passed all of that. And I think we're now absorbing pre-existing collections,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah,
Yeah, that's the stage.
and with the rise of the takeover of digital projection and the conversion of media into the digital format, the film elements are being left behind. And all of what you just said there, there are the folks there to come and pick them up, to repurpose them or reuse them and keep them from being trash, which is unfortunately what has happened to a lot of the film stock and the film that was produced and made available both for TV and otherwise.
Well, let's play another clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film.
The thing about film is that seeing the occasional line and splice and scratch, we connect to that because film is not perfect. And that imperfection connects to the imperfection we have in us as human beings. We're not perfect, and so we could connect to a film which is also not perfect. We can connect to that line, that scratch, that cue mark.
Whoa.
And you know how when you see the pictures move, even in a still shot, you see the grain kind of moves and lives. We move, we live. The film moves, and the film lives. That's the connection.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking about Film is Dead, Long Live Film. This is a documentary about preserving the analog photochemical films that played in cinemas for well over a century before digital came along. We're joined today by director Peter Flynn, as well as film archivist Greg Hamilton. So, Peter, one of the hazards that comes up in the film is vinegar syndrome. And you see all this footage of films that have not been stored very well, and they have mildew, they have vinegar syndrome. And in some cases, there are very few usable frames. There's, you know, just this one print remaining of some classic silent film, but it's really so seriously damaged. And along come the digital restorers. And, you know, a lot of artists nowadays have a problem with AI. And certainly there's art theft happening with generative AI that's really not cool. But when you have a great old film that's in the public domain and you use artificial intelligence upscaling on it, all of a sudden, you know, you can have that film back with you again.
Right. Right. You know, it's very easy to cast digital as the enemy in all of this, the soulless, lifeless corporate idea of digital technology, and to contrast it negatively with the beauty, the tactile beauty and the texture of film. But, you know, digital technologies have enabled private collectors, have given them the ability to scan their own prints, to digitize their own prints and restore them in some ways. So digital technologies are giving a new life to a lot of this. But I'm curious, like, what gets lost when we go from photochemicals to ones and zeros? We retain the images, we retain the narrative, we retain the soundtrack. But what do we lose? We lose the experience of seeing it on a projector. We lose the soundtrack of the chatter of the projector. Film becomes something different when it's on a hard drive or on a cell phone, right? Than when it's something that's in a can that needs to be taken care of, that needs to be wound and rewound, and it just becomes something else. And I'm very curious to kind of explore what it is that we're losing when we go to digital.
Well, I agree with you on that. There is definitely a difference between film projection and digital projection. There's an immediacy that is different about the projected image through film. And I think part of it is that it's a different process, but it's also has its own, you know, modicum of imperfection. You don't necessarily, you know, you think about it because you're there to see, like, you know, whatever it is that's on the film. But the film itself is a medium that carries the weight of time. And there's various imperfections. There's different things that remind you that what you're looking at is something that is flipping through a machine. You know, it's a piece of celluloid that is projected and it's not crystal clear. You know, there's something that is, I guess, even almost like three-dimensional about it compared to, you know, a flat digital experience. Not to denigrate digital at all. I'm a huge fan of it. It certainly makes it easier to store things. But, you know, there is something special about that film projection experience.
Yeah. So. A number of years ago, I went to see one of the Star Trek films. I think it was Star Trek IV at a movie theater. And it was a 35mm presentation here in Boston. And the programmer came out at the start of the film and said, look, we got the print, but it's in really bad shape. It's got scratches. It's got missing reel ends are terrible, and I don't know if you guys want to see this. We have it on DCP. Give me your choice. And resoundingly, the audience said, we want to see the film. And so what did they see? Well, what they saw was a print that had every screening that thing had etched into it. Mm. It had the vertical stripes from when it was run through a projector bed. It had the horizontal stripes from when it was on a platter system. So it had decades, four decades of damage built into it, and maybe an added layer of damage from that screening, right? And so in a sense, we were watching a live performance of a film print. It was different from every other screening. It would be different from whatever subsequent screenings it had, although this one was on its last legs. I don't know if it would see too many more screenings. So there was something very lovely about that, about seeing a 40-year-old film and seeing those 40-year-old scratches on it and that layers of history on that, which digital, of course, can erase. And it will look beautiful and it will sound beautiful, but it will not have that age.
That character.
You know, it's like the little filter that we put on our screens, right, that de-ages us, that reduces the blemishes. That's kind of what digital is. We all look great, but we've lost something of our character. and the years we've experienced. So I think that's something that's definitely lost.
Nowadays, we have young filmmakers adding in the dirt and the scratches.
Well, this is true. Yeah, this is which, you know, when I made the film about film projectionists and analog film history, that would infuriate projectionists because they said that's evidence of me and my kind not doing our jobs correctly. We were supposed to leave that print pristine at the end, not have these scratches on it. But, you know, that was the minority of collectors, to be honest.
Yeah, Peter, you have all of these collectors who are kind of heroes while being outlaws at the same time. You mentioned Louis DiCrescenzo. Also, Ira Gallen is in there, Skip Elsheimer, Jack Theakston. Yeah, they've
Bob
all...
Bob Firmenich, yeah.
They've all sort of had their brushes with the big copyright holders.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And in the case of Bob Firmenich and Jack Theakston of the 3D Film Archive, a lot of their efforts is in tracking down and securing permission and rights permission and dealing with a film that is locked away in a vault or whose copyright status is very murky. And there's a lot of those titles that, well, who owns this? Well, the paperwork goes back 40 years and it's not quite so clear cut. Frequently, what you'll find is that people will recoil from releasing it out of fear of any public lawsuit down the line. And sometimes it takes a leap of faith. There's an immense, you know, for a hobby that is fundamentally embedded in love and passion, there's tremendous amount of hostility in this hobby. The collectors hate the studios. The studios hate the collectors. The studios and the collectors hate the archives. The archives hate everybody. And so there's all this kind of infighting, and certain collectors don't like other collectors, and I'll go to my death and I'll destroy this print before anybody else gets their hands on it. There was a lot of that. Most of all of that infighting, I think, has kind of gone away now. And there's a great and I think increasingly healthy relationship between collectors and studios and the archives, but that wasn't always the case. There was that point when the studios were actively pursuing collectors, you know, and were using the FBI to hunt down and imprison and fine collectors. And it was quite a strange and frightening period for
you,
collectors.
You speak to that in your film.
Yeah, tell us about Captain Celluloid and the film Pirates.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And that's a film that was made in the mid-1960s, made primarily by film collectors about the hazards and the thrills of film collecting. And it's about an organization that illegally acquires prints and dupes them and sells them, and which a lot of collectors were doing. And maybe not collectors, but a lot of, say, enterprising individuals realized that money could be made from absconding with a print of, you know, it was running in a movie theater and then making 16 millimeter dupes of it and selling those. So that was a kind of a roaring trade back at that time. So these collectors made a short film about this and this superhero type character named Captain Celluloid, whose job it was to hunt down these nefarious film pirates. And it's a great kind of time capsule look at film collecting in that, you know, mid-century America. It's wonderful. And it also just kind of taps into the growing hostilities between these institutions and collectors that would then explode in the 1970s when the FBI actively began to hunt down collectors. People like Roddy McDowall had their collection seized. Roddy McDowall had prints of Planet of the Apes and How Green Was My Valley seized.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who were referred to as eccentric collectors, but some of those eccentric collectors were celebrities like Roddy McDowall and Hugh Hefner.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, there's a fascinating history. It isn't just the films and the film history that makes the hobby of film collecting fascinating and interesting. There's the history of film collecting itself and the various generations of film collectors. That to me is just a great, great story. So I was very happy in my own kind of small, underfunded way to tell something of that story and hopefully carry that torch on to a new generation.
Let's play another clip from the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film.
In the beginning, as they say, there was just film. And then there were film collectors, and pretty soon there were film pirates to feed the film collectors. It's almost impossible to protect a film against pirates.
I've been offered films. A lot of things get thrown away in the trash cans, and hey, there's not a trash can out there around town that doesn't have a film collector lurking under it.
Piracy, as it is now and as it could be in the future, is a cancer in the belly of the film business.
They were concerned that we were making videotapes. They don't understand film collectors. Film collectors hate videotapes. VHS tapes were the worst. A true film collector wants film. They don't want tape.
I could give you a list this high of the busts that have been made by the FBI, prosecutions by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And for the first time in the last 6 months or so, and increasingly in the years ahead, they're going to jail.
They knocked on the door. They said they had a warrant to search the garage. They never did come in the house. They checked the garage and a storage unit we had that our landlady was kind enough to give them information about. But yeah, it was scary. We were all supposed to get 6 months suspended sentences. And, you know, I went down to court that day. I didn't even say goodbye to my wife because I was coming home. And the judge said 6 months and didn't say suspended afterwards. And they hauled me off in handcuffs, which was a surprise.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about Film is Dead, Long Live Film. This is a documentary about preserving the analog photochemical films that played in cinemas for well over a century before digital came along. We're joined today by director Peter Flynn, as well as film archivist Greg Hamilton. I don't know that there's a villain in this film, in Film is Dead, Long Live Film, but the name Jack Valenti does come up. And and this is a guy who worked for Lyndon Johnson before becoming a lobbyist. He was the longtime head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, where he helped create the rating system for movies. In 1998, Valenti lobbied for the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. For me, I'm against anything that restricts the free flowing of films, anything that locks a film away, that keeps it from an audience, that keeps it from being viewed, is to me the enemy. And whatever we can do, legally or not, to ensure that these films continue to circulate and flow and live, I'm all for. Maybe a very simplistic and maybe a very naive view of the situation, but I think that's what's important here, that these films continue to circulate. And any effort to prevent that needs to be opposed.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, especially after the DMCA came along in 1998. Was that a burden on collectors that suddenly they were going further underground with their collections?
In some cases, it just depends on what it was that you had in your collection, I think. Mm-hmm. That's probably one thing to consider. You know, with ephemera and stuff that disappears on the fringe, people don't care about that quite so much. But if you were out there trying to show like a print of a movie that, you know, was released by a studio, lots of times they don't even hear about it. So they don't know. But you would have to take precautions to make sure that the screening was not widely broadcast so that people could watch it, but you wouldn't be pursued such as it is.
Peter, you talked to a fellow in the film named George Willimon, and he's the head of the, I believe, the Library of Congress's Nitrate Film Collection?
The Nitrate Film Collection Manager, yes, George. And George has a great affinity with film collectors, and he's just a wonderful, personable man. You know, when we talk about the relationships between collectors and studios and the archives thawing in recent years, it's thanks to people like George Willimon, who really maintain a very close and personable relationship with collectors. For years, a collector did not want to deal with an archive because they felt it'll go into an archive. The archive will inform that it came from me. They'll inform the studio that it came from me. And I'll get into trouble with that. That has since changed because, you know, the studios now realize that they can put an extra feature on their Blu-ray release of Gone with the Wind or whatever that came from a collector. So the hostilities have ceased. And in my experience, I can't think of an archive that has a more congenial relationship with collectors than the Library of Congress. And that is largely because of people like George Willeman.
So the film talks a little bit about nitrate film, which is the film stock that was used for the first several decades. And I think people have gotten wary about nitrate film after seeing the film Cinema Paradiso, where there's a big fire in the projection booth.
Well, that's true. And nitrate required a certain type of film collector, someone who was not of a nervous disposition. What's interesting about nitrate and the collectors of nitrate is that the ones I've met and known were projectionists, and they were projectionists back in the days of nitrate. And so nitrate was no dangerous than a box of matches. If you treated it carefully and you looked after it right, it was harmless. Newer generations, and particularly people who've gone through film preservation schools, have this fear and anxiety around nitrate that a projectionist of the 40s and 50s wouldn't have. But it is dangerous, and there's been many fires and many lives lost and many films lost too. So it is something that has to be carefully handled and preserved. Now, nothing that was released for the home market, that is in 16 millimeter, was printed on nitrate film stock. So all 16 millimeter is safety film stock. So we don't have that concern there. But films made prior to 1952 are on nitrate film stock, 35 millimeter theatrical films. And again, that requires very careful handling, very careful storage, low humidity, low temperatures. And for the most part, most of the collectors I know pass that on immediately to the Library of Congress. And the Library of Congress has a great policy about that. If you have a nitrate print, they will send you the shipping details. They will have it shipped from your home to their archives as special hazardous material. And they pay for all of that. They make it very easy on you. They want that stuff in their archives and not in your basement. Oh, hi, wow. George, if you're listening.
Yes, yes.
Now, let me take issue with one thing you said to me.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Oh, I've
said
please.
My film does not have a villain. And I disagree. I think it does. And it has the greatest villain and the ultimate villain, death. The film is about death and the fight against death, right? Film dies and decays. We die and decay. And with death, we get forgotten. And everybody we knew and every thought we had in our head gets lost. And the wonderful thing about film was, of course, that it held on to things that were meant to die and be forgotten. And collectors have played their part in ensuring that aspects of our culture and the people within it have not died and have not been forgotten, that they continue on in some form or another. My hope with the film is that 300, 200 years from now, somebody's going to open a can in an archive somewhere, and there will be the name Louis De Crescenzo. And they'll say, who is this guy? And they'll be able to, on some kind of, newfangled technology, they'll be able to plug in my film, and they'll get to see who Lou was. And they'll hear his voice, and they'll get a sense of his personality. And so that's the ultimate villain, right, is the finality of death. And the great struggle against that is to rise above it and be remembered and somehow live beyond the few years that are allotted to us on this planet. And I think film does that more effectively than any other medium, in my opinion. And the efforts to preserve and hold on to that is, in a sense, the greatest human struggle, isn't it? To say that we will not die, we will not be forgotten, we will not go gently into that good night. So that is the villain of the film, and that struggle is to overcome it in some small way. Until, of course, the asteroid hits us and we're all, oblivion. But until that moment, we'll have film.
Well, on that note... Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today about the documentary Film is Dead, Long Live Film. Our guests have been director Peter Flynn and film archivist Greg Hamilton. Peter and Greg, great to have you on the show.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us back. Can I tell your listeners about one other thing before we go?
Please do.
For those of you who love documentaries, obviously, if you're listening now, you love documentaries. On March 4th, I'm going to be bringing a couple of documentaries done by the filmmaker Les Blank in celebration of Mardi Gras over at the Clinton Street Theater on March 4th. at 7 p.m. So that, and also remember that March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, we'll be showing Film is Dead, Long Live Film. The screening is going to be over at the Clinton Street Theater. We'll be doing that at 7 o'clock. But I'm just really excited for people to not only to see your film, but also just to grasp the fact that they have something like this going on in their own backyard.
And Greg, I understand that there's a new website for the Nybeck Film Archive.
Indeed. Thank you for reminding me. For those that are interested, check out nybeckarchive.org. That's nybeckarchive.org.
Peter, for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about Film is Dead, Long Live Film, where would they look?
You can visit my website at coldeyefilms.com, coldeyefilms. Yes, I can spell it, coldeyefilms.com. And we will be releasing the film on Blu-ray shortly as a double disc set with The Dying of the Light, my documentary on the history and demise of analog film projection. So keep an eye out for that. And if you visit my website, you'll see information on that upcoming release.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media @wordsandpicture.